back to the bin.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to Back to the Bins. I'm Paul Spataro, and this week it is my pleasure to welcome Mr. Chris Eberle onto the show. You may know Chris from previous appearances. Usually he's with people from a show that people formerly from a show that I don't recall the name of, but mostly on Comic Timing now. And the other guys were all, everybody was supposed to come on today, but everybody had, I don't know, lame excuses. I have to work. I have to go out to dinner, whatever. I'm in a play. But thankfully, Chris didn't bail on me. So the two of us are here to talk some. And we were just debating Silver or Bronze Age. So we're going to talk a little bit more about that as we go on. But we're here to look at some late 60s, early 70s books. And it's funny, Chris, every time I have you on, I always look forward to seeing what book you're going to pick.
Thank you.
Because it's usually something that is thought-provoking, and very often it's something where I say, "Oh, this is a gem."
Let's see how I do this time.
Yeah, I'm not sure today's is a gem. Today it's very nostalgic for me. It's a good book. I'm not saying it's bad, but I don't know if it's a gem, and we'll talk a little bit more about that.
Sure.
But before we get to that, because we started the conversation, how do we demark the breakdown from the Silver Age to the Bronze Age?
So the way I've always looked at it, after giving it probably far too much thought in my life, I mean, there's different schools of thought on that, right? Some people say, well, so we're talking Marvel books tonight. So once Marvel goes from 12-cent covers to 15-cent covers, which is around 1970, you're in the Bronze Age. Other people might say that because we're going to be talking about a Spider-Man book tonight, it's when Gwen Stacy is killed, and that's when the Bronze Age begins in 1973. There's different schools of thought on it. I tend to go with, as we get into the 1970s, there's a lot of changes going on in the industry. The Comics Code is liberalized in large part because of the Spidey drug issues, you know, 96 and 98. Yeah. And, you know, Marvel starts doing their horror comics, all the different monster books, you know, Morbius, Werewolf, Dracula, Man-Thing, so forth. You get like the second wave of Marvel creators, you know, led by Roy Thomas, but, you know, Englehart and Frank Brunner and Jim Starlin.
Jerry
Conway. Thank you. My God, he should have been the first person I mentioned. Who, you know, bring...
Like Glenn Wein. I'm sorry. I'm just thinking off the top of my head.
Glenn Wein, Marv Wolfman, et cetera, right? So all these great creators. And they're bringing a sensibility. I mean, they all came to the industry as fans of comics. They all grew up reading comics. But, you know, they're baby boomers. They're coming up in a different generation than the Stan Lee era. And they're bringing a different sensibility, you know, building on what he and Kirby and Ditko and the rest did. So that kind of feels like the Bronze Age to me, just because, for lack of a better term, I think there's a greater sophistication in some of the characterization, the plots, the subplots in particular, in a lot of those books. And I think the two books we're discussing tonight, like Fantastic Four 73, is very much in the Silver Age. And I enjoyed it very much from that perspective. And then I think the Spider-Man 82, it's kind of bridging, like it's written by Stan Lee. It's very much a Stan Lee script, but I think it's also a later period Stan Lee script. And I've mentioned in other recordings that for me, Stan Lee's at the peak of his powers as a Spider-Man writer in like the late 60s into the very early 70s, which I that's when I enjoy his writing the most on the character. And this book is an example of that. What do you think? What is the Bronze Age?
Well, first of all, I think we're kind of in agreement because first of all, I think you made a good point by distinguishing Marvel from DC in this, because I've often mentioned that DC was mired in the Silver Age much, much longer than Marvel
was. Yes, I agree with that.
Yep. You know, they had the occasional point where they touched their toe in the water of the Bronze Age and then kind of went back. Did you just disappear or just your camera went off?
It's just the camera.
Okay. You know, there were things that they did that were a little bit more sophisticated, that it felt like they were trying to bring them up, you know, like the Kryptonite No More storyline or the Green Lantern, Green Arrow books. like they were trying to be a little bit more sophisticated. And then they'd go back to, you know, Superman's on the cover and he's eating all the hamburgers in the world and not letting anybody have them, you know. So like they kept retreating back to the Silver Age, it felt like to me. So distinguishing the two is a good point. With Marvel, I think the point that you made that I totally go with is when we got the advent of the new writers. I think that's when it switched from the silver to the bronze. And I'm not giving Roy Thomas credit for that, because Roy was kind of a bridge between the silver and the bronze. He came on in the Silver Age. He was kind of Stan's mentee or his student, and he learned from Stan and was working from there. And then later on, they brought in all those other people. And that's, to me, when the Bronze Age really started.
I would agree with that. I think what I would say further about Thomas is that he's like a bridging figure as well. Like you said, he came to Marvel in 1965, if I remember correctly. So still pretty early on in the Marvel Age. And he was working by Lee, Ditko, Kirby, Buscema, Cole and Kane, all these icons. And so he very much was versed in that, but he also had the eye for talent to recognize all these new people who were coming up and to give them the room to create the way they were. So,
yeah, I think he was instrumental to the Bronze Age coming in, but when he was hired, that isn't the advent of it yet.
Fair enough.
The other interesting point I thought you made was about Stan's writing on Spider-Man, because if you look at the series from the start, obviously Ditko had a very, very strong hand in the stories ultimately it left it, you know, led to disagreements between him and Stan and led to Ditko leaving the book altogether. I think when Romita came on, and I love John Romita's artwork, but I think there was more of a I think it was more in the way of teamwork between the two of them, as opposed to two different voices. I think when you look at some of the earlier stuff, you could see where Ditko drew something and then Stan puts dialogue in that changes the intent of what Ditko wanted to do.
Absolutely.
So, you know, there was definitely some tension between the two. But then after that, once Romita came on, you know, we had things like the Spider-Man No More, the tablet stories. You know, there's so many good Spider-Man stories in that era.
Yeah, the Clay Tablet saga is one of my all-time favorites.
And I know some people don't care for it at all, but I liked when they brought in Blackie Drago as the new Vulture, and then he had to fight Adrian Toomes eventually. I thought there was some cool stuff in there. So, I definitely like that. And then, you know, once Jerry Conway took over, the book took on a whole new level of maturation.
Well, I've mentioned before that in other recordings that Jerry Conway, rest in peace, he just passed. But I think his command of the characterization of the subplots of Spider-Man's supporting cast really took the book to the next level. I remember, as a very young kid, I was getting back issues or Marvel Tales reprints of Conway's stories. I'm reading these in the late 70s and in the early 80s. And even as a younger kid, I was just really wowed by the voice that he gave the characters. And I thought he was a master, especially of Spider-Man's inner dialogue or monologue with himself, which, mm-hmm. they don't do that anymore, really. And again, I miss the thought bubbles, always say that. So Conway, for me, is like he obviously learned and was inspired by Stan Lee, but he was a very young man. He was barely out of his teens when he started writing Spider-Man.
I don't think he was out of his teens. I think he was 19.
He might have been 19. I think you're right. Yeah. And then it was early 20s. So, I thought he brought the character to just the next level. And obviously the death of Gwen and is all that is probably the consummate example of that. But, the story we're going to look at tonight is not from that period, but I think it's, like we'll get into bridging. We'll get into why I selected this story.
But just to go on the Jerry Conway point a little bit. When Facebook first became, widespread, and I was Facebook friends with Jerry Conway and his birthday came up, and I realized I think he was 10 years older than me. And I sent him a happy birthday message and I said something like, boy, when I was, 10 years old reading Spider-Man, I thought you were so much older than me. And now, you're not as much older than me as I thought. And he was like, give it time. You'll catch up. And, you know, it was pretty cool. And then I met him at New York Comic Con once. He was a gentleman and a pleasure to meet. So his passing was very sad for me.
Oh, yeah. I was really sad to hear about it. I mean, he's one of my all-time favorite writers in comics, period. And he's probably my favorite Spider-Man scribe. If I really had to think about it, and because there's so many writers I've appreciated over the course of the character's history, but his stories, part of it's nostalgia, because that's a lot of his stories were some of the first Spider-Man stories I read. But also as I go back and I read them as a middle-aged man, they still really resonate for me. Especially considering how young he was, like the stuff he was turning out was really impressive. And
yeah,
I love the
fact really
that, I mean, this would never happen today. They're like, yeah, well, Stanley's leaving Spider-Man, 19-year-old kid, you take it.
Yeah, who would have thought that he was their flagship title back then.
Yeah.
I mean, they always called
was,
Fantastic Four the world's greatest comic magazine, but Spider-Man was the character.
Yeah, and you can't imagine anybody company doing something like that today. So it's also indicative of the time period as well and how really still really small that industry was. You didn't have, you know, the massive intellectual property aspect of it that you see today. So, Jerry Conway was the best.
One of the interesting things about his run on Spider-Man, I thought, was how he developed and changed the character of Mary Jane. And we're going to see Mary Jane in this book that you brought today.
One of the most important things he did. Absolutely.
That whole scene at the end of the death of Gwen Stacy, uh-huh, when he tells her to leave and she just comes back in and sits there quietly, that is powerful stuff.
Well, that the sophistication of that is so impressive because he... there's very little dialogue on that page, and it's just her looking at Peter, and she is going to leave, and then she closes the door, stays in the room, and I mean the masterful storytelling, the narrative there. Obviously it's Gil Kane and John Romita artwork, so you have two veteran masters working with you, but it's one of the best. To me, it's still one of the best pages in comics.
Agreed. I totally agree. I have when I met Jerry Conway, I purchased a print of the cover of the first issue of that two issue story and had him autograph it for me. And I have that hanging up in my home office. It's just a print. It's not like it's not like I have the original artwork, but you know what? In the frame, it looks like the original artwork. So I can go with that. Again, I didn't want to make this too much of a talk on Jerry Conway, but he's also one of my favorites. Just another side note, because we recently, one of the random books we covered was Green Lantern number one, when he first went from Showcase to his own series. In that issue of Green Lantern number one, there's a letter from Roy Thomas, and that would predate his working for Marvel. And he tells about his subscribing to All-Star Comics, and it turned out to be All-Star Western when he got it.
I've read that. Yep.
So it's interesting. You know, I mean, obviously that was the transition, just to kind of, I think, put a little bow on the conversation we were having when we brought in those new people. That was the transition from grown men writing comics for young kids to people who grew up loving these comics.
Exactly.
Starting to write them. And 100%. I think that made a difference. I think that the labor of love aspect of it shows. I recently had an episode where I had Carl Kiesel and Ron Randall on. And the one thing that came through loud and clear is nobody gets into comics to make money. It's because you love comics.
I can imagine. I had a similar experience as a retailer.
Yeah, you know, and I was thinking of that today. I was thinking, boy, I wish Wild Pig had been more successful and still existed, because I would love to swing by every once in a while. I was at my friend Dave's house in Staten Island this past week, and the last time when you were closing that store, I had gone with Dave. I went to his house, and from his house to your store, it was only like about a 15 to 20 minute ride.
Oh, terrific. Well, we gave it a go for 18 years.
You gave it a go twice.
Yeah, the whole thing was 18 years total. So
yeah, it's too bad. I would enjoy patronizing your store and getting to come by and visit every once in a while. But
thanks, man.
Such is life. So we got the two books. I will give you the choice as to whose goes first.
Well, let's do FF.
Okay, so I took Fantastic Four number 73, and I will tell you that the reason I picked this book is when I was a young kid and I first started buying older books, I had seen this cover, and I said, I have to have this book.
Oh, of course. Come on, look at all those characters in the front.
And it goes against a lot of my critique that I give on these books a lot of times, because it's just the characters against a plain white background. And I criticize the lack of a background, very frequently. But in this case, I think because of what the image is, you don't need a background, and the background would just be distracting. And I often rate the books on, if I was a kid on the stands and I saw this book and I wasn't otherwise inclined to buy it, would the cover make me want to? And there's a resounding yes on this one. So, you know, I wanted this book badly. This book was released on January 9th, 1968. And it's got a cover date of April of 1968. It's Fantastic Four number 73. It's got a 12-cent price tag. And the cover that I'm talking about says Giant Guest Star Bonanza. And it has the three active members at that time of the Fantastic Four, which were Reed Richards, The Thing, and the Human Torch, facing off directly against Daredevil, Thor, and Spider-Man. I just can't say enough good things about this particular cover. The story opens. Now, this comes off of Daredevil 38. I think it's 37 and 38, unless it's 38 and 39. I'm not 100% sure. Where Dr. Doom, for reasons that escape me, decided to switch bodies with Daredevil and use that as a method of attacking the Fantastic Four. But that had been resolved already. But the Fantastic Four were warned that Doom was going to come in Daredevil's body, so they don't know it's been resolved. So they're preparing for what's going to come. Reed's got a giant piece of Kirby tech that he's doing something with. I don't even know what. Daredevil, and a lot of the motivation in this book is questionable to me, because Daredevil's insisting that he has to go and talk to them. Meanwhile, maybe he should be trying to give him a phone call or something first. And they're taking the attack first mode. So as he's coming, the torch attacks him. He dives out of the way, uses, I guess, a piece of scaffolding to flip over, and he basically tricks the torch into crashing into a water barrel, water tower, rather. And interestingly there, he says he'll regain consciousness as soon as he dries out. I'm not sure that the wetness is what's causing him to lose consciousness. But he drags the torch over. Spider-Man comes over. He explains what's going on. Spider-Man immediately sides with him instead of saying, hey, why don't we try and reason with the FF and let them know what's going on. Spider-Man says, well, we're going to need more help. And I recently saw someone, and he runs over and he gets Thor, who is in the middle of a battle with the Wrecker that's around issue 150 of his series. He's also been depowered because Odin wasn't sure if he was worthy, so he lessened his powers. Mjolnir is no longer enchanted. So he's talking to Spider-Man. Spider-Man does the Marty McFly calling him a chicken thing, and then he's willing to go along. Meanwhile, Daredevil is fighting with the Thing and Mr. Fantastic. And he's actually holding his own fairly well, all things considered. And then finally, Thor agrees to go with Spider-Man, and he can't fly with his hammer because of the lack of enchantment. So he's piggybacking at one point on Spider-Man, and he's climbing along I don't know if it's some sort of telephone wire or something. But anyway, as they're making their way over, the torch regains consciousness, and he goes after them. And Spider-Man basically does the divide and conquer, says, I'll take on the torch, you go take on the Thing. So Thor goes over to do that, and him and the Thing start getting into a battle. We have a really cool Kirby splash page of Thor is hitting the Thing in the chest with Mjolnir, but yeah. I guess the lack of enchantment makes it a little less powerful, because the Thing is actually doing really well against him. While that's going on, Spider-Man is battling with the Human Torch. Daredevil is battling with Reed, and at some point they will, at some point the battle just kind of gets interrupted. The thing hits Thor and nothing happens, and Reed goes to punch Daredevil, and it's blocked, and it's because Sue knows that it's a real...
Because she was watching the 6 o'clock news, and she realized that this Donnybrook needn't have occurred at all.
Yeah. And that's how this is your traditional Marvel that superheroes have to fight, but it's fight for an entire issue. And the problem I have with it is I enjoy the battle. I enjoy the artwork. The problem is just the motivations of everybody seem so forced.
Well, Paul, I really, really happy that you chose this book. I hadn't read it in, you know, many years. And what I really loved about it, and again, the nostalgia was how many issues have I read in my comic book reading life where we shouldn't forget that besides being, you know, at his peak, a great writer, Stan Lee was also the consummate salesman and promoter. So nothing's going to sell a book better, especially to that young Paul Spataro as a kid when he sees it, then all the heroes are going at each other. And then when you have to force that kind of altercation, sometimes that means you have to sort of, shall we say, reinvent some of the personalities and motivations of the characters involved. Reed has never appeared more stupid in any FF comic I've ever read than in this one. He keeps asking himself, you know, is this really what's happening? And am I right? And I was laughing out loud because Marvel did this so many times in the Silver Age where they would, you know, engineer these battles because obviously it's going to sell books and it's fun between their characters. It's always a misunderstanding. They don't have the right information. And then eventually at the end, everybody has a revelation. It's resolved. It was a hoot and a half to read this again. And especially anytime I get to look at Jack Kirby and Joe Sinnott art, I'm on cloud nine. And this, I don't even think this is even one of Kirby's like best issues of the FF compared to some of the work he'd done, like in issue numbers 50s and 60s, for example. But it's still eye popping. Like you said, the opening splash page with the inevitable Kirby tech and things grumbling and Reed's doing it, you know, working on it. It was just put a big smile on my face. I was laughing out loud reading this. It was so much fun. I also love how Stan is always promoting, oh, this happened in this book and this character over here. And he's constantly doing that. It's just, it has a certain charm to it now when I look at an issue like this.
To me, it's actually beyond charm when it's not just the promotion. I just always loved the way the universe was interwoven. So
of course,
to be able to say, this is what's going on in Daredevil. This is what's going on in Spider-Man. And Spider-Man, I think this was just before the magazine-sized Spectacular Spider-Man came out. I think this was like either the same month or the month before. And Thor, it's right in the middle of the storyline that they take on that particular with the record. But that's, I mean, it was easy because that was also Stan and Jack. So it's easy for them to put that together. I thought Jack's Daredevil is a little too bulky, the way he was drawn. Other than that, I don't really have a lot of criticism. He doesn't draw a great Spider-Man.
Obviously, as you know, he drew the Amazing Fantasy 15 cover. Mm-hmm. Lee rejected Steve Ditko's cover, which you can find online, which is also, I think, great. And, you know, Kirby has a particular approach to heroic characters, and for most of them, it's magnificent. It's a character like Thor, it's godlike, you know, Captain America, all of that. Daredevil, though, I think really spoiled by Gene Colan, who drew a really, like, live, acrobatic character. And, you know, that just wasn't Kirby's approach. And the same thing struck me that Daredevil, the way he was rendered, I mean, it's Kirby. I'm always going to enjoy it, but it didn't strike me as well as like when Colan does it or other artists. And Kirby, I mean, his Spider-Man never really, I mean, he didn't draw Spider-Man that often, you know, that covers and promotional art, occasional appearances like this, but, you know, it doesn't capture the essence of the character for me the way other artists have, but these are minor quibbles. you know, no one draws these Donnybrooks. Like you said, that splash page with the Thor and the Thing going at it and Mjolnir smashing the Thing. Just, I mean, it's breathtaking stuff.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely. You know, I've often said, you know, bad Kirby is still good. You know, it's bad Kirby is still better than most people. So, you know, I mean, and I will eliminate some of the very, very end of his career. I discount that stuff. But, you know, this is Kirby at, you know, if it's not at his peak, it's just ever so slightly past.
Oh, yeah. It's Kirby still doing Silver Age Marvel, you know, turning out an ungodly number of pages and titles a month, which was what he was doing was, when you think about it now and look back on it, was superhuman, essentially. I mean, the toll the guy probably took on the guy. I mean, the amount of work he produced is incredible. And, you know, this book is just another example of that. It's a really fun issue. And again, it's as long as you don't approach it cynically, it's the classic Marvel misunderstanding. Let's have the heroes fight.
Yeah, well, it's you know, you say cynically, I say, as long as you don't look at it too closely, it's the motivations of the characters. I try not to be a cynic all that much, and I love this stuff. You know, I think you and I are in the same ballpark as far as our appreciation of it.
Of course.
But, you know, when you're looking at it from the perspective of, hey, let's analyze it a little bit, you know, some of the motivations here just seem a little off, because at some point you think they'd say, especially with Reed having these misgivings, you know, yeah. Do I know if it's still him or whatever? You think he would take the time to try and find out. And I'm a little, you know, Stan's science is always always makes me scratch my head a little bit, because they were able to confirm that it was really Daredevil that made the phone call based on his voice patterns.
He had an audio recorder of some kind. Yeah.
So if you have that ability, why didn't you say, all right, let's just do this again and we'll see if it's really you.
Now, Paul, but if we do that, there's no fight. Come on.
No, it's exactly it. I think, you know, if just, I suspect that, you know, when we talk about the Marvel method, Stan, you know, said, okay, we're going to have this Donnybrook between the characters, and here we're going to have this, and they're not going to really understand. They're going to still think it's going on. And Jack just, you know, went to town, and it didn't leave an opening for him to come up with, well, we did this, and that's why we're still fighting. So it's just like, you know what? Yeah, we're fighting because we don't know any better. That's a good enough reason.
It's a good enough. It's a valid point. And again, you mentioned the Marvel method, and especially at this point, I mean, if you read into the history, I mean, Lee's given these artists a few sentences, maybe a paragraph about what the story's going to consist of, and then they, like you said, these are all top flight: Buscema, Kane, Colin, Kirby. I mean, they know what to do, and Lee knew that, so. Then Kirby just renders this fantastic combat issue, basically.
Yeah. I think, you know, I'm not sure. Like, sometimes when I have an issue with how things are presented, I could say, well, if you added one dialogue box in here that said such and such, it would make more sense to me. I'm not sure that there's any one box you could put in here. I think you have to give me at least a page to try and justify the fight. And since I don't have that page, I got to run with it as it is.
Well, luckily, Sue was pregnant at this time, correct?
Yes, that's why it's just pretty much the three of them. And I think Crystal joins them like very shortly after this.
She does, to take Sue's place temporarily. But again, it's nice that, you know, Lee isn't always, you know, lauded for the way he depicts some of his female characters. But Sue, you know, comes in here and essentially saves the day and is level-headed and sets everybody straight.
Yeah. Now this is, I mean, like I said, I could sit here and point out some plot holes, but this is great stuff. You know, the one thing that caught my eye, though, is on the second page, when they have the close-up of Daredevil's face, didn't they usually have, like, red opaque covers over his eyes?
Usually, yes.
So that would have been an error that they did it that way.
I forgot that that was the case, yeah.
Which would totally make sense, because as a blind man, even though he's got all the senses and all of that, he's not getting his visual of the scene through his eyes. He's getting it through his radar sense.
And so, Reed even acknowledges, how could you have seen through my stretching body when I was covering your head? And there's one point where Reed says something like, you know, you sound like a lawyer. So there's these fun little in-joke.
Yeah,
joke,
you sound like a lawyer. Right? I liked that.
And you know, what I always love about two things. One, like you pointed out, the shared universe, which we take for granted today. But I mean, that again, that was one of the things that made Marvel so radical in the Silver Age. And the fact that Lee will drop references to reality. So he mentions the Israeli general Moshe Dayan at one point.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I made a note of that also.
Who was a very dashing, eye patch wearing Israeli general from like the Six-Day War, which just happened in 1967. So again, Lee, you know, paying attention to the news and just sort of dropping these names and concepts or themes into the stories. We do that all the time, which again gave the comics this tangible feeling of reality, which so many readers appreciated at that time.
Yeah, the only thing about that, and I go back and forth, I like the fact that it's given it that sense of reality. On the other hand, it does kind of date the book. Because, you know, Diane was no longer a political figure.
Yeah.
You know, then it starts getting like, you know, I would imagine kids reading this today would say, who's Moshe Dayan?
Most people would. It's just, but I just love how it puts the book in a certain place in a certain time. And again, they're just thinking, okay, what are we just getting out this month? They're probably not thinking, you know, what's this going to mean years down the road? So I always appreciate it when I see those references in these old books.
And for what it's worth, Moshe Dayan had a very cool look because he was missing an eye, so he had an eye patch.
Yeah,
he looked like one of the toughest world leaders when you see them all. So
yeah,
he was a cool one to reference.
Yeah.
So I guess we could rate this one and cover yours.
All right.
For me, this cover is an A+. I love this cover, and like I said, it as soon as I started buying books and I saw that this one was in the back issues, it was one of the first ones I had to obtain. I wouldn't care if it was all blank pages inside. Just by the cover, I needed to have this. The interior art, it's not the best Kirby, but it's very good Kirby. There's a lot of really good stuff. And Joe Sinnott is, no question, he was Kirby's best inker in my mind.
I agree.
I don't think anybody could even compete. So the artwork is still excellent, even though it's not the best Kirby. I'm going to give it an A-, which I almost feel like I'm being harsh. And the story is silly. I wish there had been just some better explanation for why they're fighting. But other than that, it's fun. Them going across the town and Thor having to use a wire and like climb across from building to building. It just, there's so much stuff in here that I just get a kick out of. So I'm going to give the story, I'm going to take off a little bit for not giving them good enough motivation, but I'm going to give it a solid B, and overall, I'm going to give the book an A-.
All right. Cover for me is an A. I mean, it's, imagine being a young reader. Was this 1968 or 69? This book came out.
68.
And you walk by the newsstand or you're in the drugstore or whatever, and you see that cover. I mean, you're putting down your 12 cents right away. So it's thrilling. It's also, you know, very good salesmanship to have a cover like that. Interior, A-. I mean, like you said, any Kirby Sinnott pages, I'm going to just devour and enjoy. I mean, so now it's like a scale of just how great everything is. So, you know, did this art strike me as much as, you know, This Man, This Monster, or the Galactus trilogy, or the intro of the Black Panther, or the Inhuman stuff? No, but Kirby was doing a lot more dynamic, experimental work in a lot of those books, like using collages and all these different things and other multimedia. So, but I mean, come on, look at that Thor thing, Donnybrook splash page. I mean, you know, that's a solid A-. The story, I'm going to give it a B+ because it was such a wonderful stroll down sort of memory lane to when I was a kid and I would have read these in reprints. I wasn't alive then, but just to devour the action. And also reading it now as an older man, you appreciate, you know, what Lee is trying to do both as a writer and as a salesman of these characters and of this world. Some of the great references we mentioned from the zeitgeist at the time. and just, you know, the classic Marvel misunderstanding, which as you read it as an older person, it's dopey, but it's also just really entertaining and fun. So B plus for that. Overall, the book is an A minus for me.
Yeah, so we landed in the same place. And you keep calling yourself an older man, and I'm older than you, so you're going to make me cry.
Oh, come on. we're both middle-aged men. Middle age is a lot older these days than it was, 20, 30 years
ago. I always think of on Golden Pond.
Oh, God.
In the movie, Henry Fonda and Katherine Hepburn. And Katherine Hepburn says, oh, the neighbors next door, they're middle-aged like us. And Henry Fonda looks at him. He's like, middle age? People don't live to be 140. So that's what I think of. And I'm not quite 70 yet. I have a ways to go for that, at least. But anyway,
you're doing fine, Paul. You're doing fine.
I'm hanging in there. Moving on to your book now.
All right.
What do you now, got for us?
So when you extended this gracious invitation, I was thinking, all right, what do I want to pick? I always love the format of your show because it compels me to just look for single issues that have always had an impact on me. And I decided, like you said in the introduction, a lot of times you'll pick books that you may consider a gem or have some tremendous sort of power behind them. This was lighter fare for me because I've been reading or rereading recently like older Spider-Man stories, and I was always taken with the period that this book is from, which is late 60s into the 70s, where I think Stan Lee is firing on all cylinders when it comes to the voice of Spider-Man, his supporting cast, their interpersonal dynamics. He had, John Buscema, Jim Mooney, John Romita Sr., all doing various inking or penciling jobs in these stories. And there was a book that came out in the 70s. So Fireside did a series of books. Remember, Fireside, of course, did Origin of Marvel Comics, Son of Origins. But in the late 70s, did a series of books focusing on individual characters. They went on Doctor Strange, I think the Fantastic Four, I want to say Iron Man. They did one on Spider-Man, The Amazing Spider-Man by Stan Lee. And I got this book like in the 80s as a kid. And it was a reprint book of several classic stories from the Silver Age and early Bronze. And 82 was in there. And it was always very close to my heart because the story, I mean, first of all, the conceit of it, Spider-Man's so desperate for money because he's the broke college student that he has this eureka moment. He says, I bet I can go on a late night talk show and they'll pay me to be a guest because he's just struggling for money. And the story is about Spider-Man trying to raise money for Flash's Fireball Party because he's going back to Vietnam, because that's going on at this time. Again, Marvel trying to be relevant. And the whole book is about him trying to figure out how can I make money and then deciding upon this, going on this talk show. And then, of course, J. Jonah Jameson is outraged that polite society is allowing Spider-Man to appear on television. And Electro, who was out of jail and on parole, comes and goes, look, if you pay me, I will attack Spider-Man on live television, unmask him. And that is the basic premise of the story. And just what I love about it is this story encompasses all the great elements of Spider-Man in the late Silver Age and early Bronze Age. First of all, the opening splash page. Dan Gavazdin of The Amazing Spider Talk, which is one of the premier Spider-Man podcasts, he always calls these pages the floating heads of guilt. And I think it perfectly captures just the essence of the character. So in this opening splash page, beautifully rendered by Romita and Mooney, it's Peter, is ill in bed as always in the background. He's in the foreground, head in his hand, thinking of all the ways that his life sucks and all the things he's dealing with, the debt, Gwen, Harry, who's got his fantastic, Fu Manchu mustache at this point. Joe Roberts and Captain Stacy figure out my identity. What about Aunt May and her health? Like I would love to own this page. If it exists, I'm sure it's worth a fortune. But it's just the essence of Spider-Man. We just get going from there. And just the book shows how masterfully lean as artists handle subplot at this point, just effortlessly in and out. Mary Jane pops up, Anna Watson to help MJ. Gwen, of course, saying, hey, we got to go to Flash's farewell party. Can you pay for it? Peter agonizing about the fact that he can't make enough, dough, so to speak, to pay for the rent, to pay for Flash's party. J. Jonah is showing his obsession with Spider-Man and how Joe Roberts, and always the shrewd critical thinker, is very suspicious of what Jonah's up to. And then, of course, you've got Gwen and Mary Jane doing their Betty and Veronica routine. And God, no one drew Gwen Stacy and Mary Jane better than Romita with the various inkers working with them. And of course, this issue also has the classic paper bag incident where Spidey has to get his costume washed because he swung over a smokestack, got all this soot all over him, and he doesn't want to appear on TV like a slob. And the laundry machine in the basement of his apartment, or pad, as he would call it in the late 60s, early 70s, there's a bunch of ladies down there, so he has to go to the neighborhood laundromat, and he conceals his face in a paper bag while he sits there as all the customers are looking at him and gaping at him as he dries his costume. And then we get to the talk show, and they've made like a Marvel analog for like Johnny Carson or Merv Griffin, and Electro attacks. And Spidey survives, but the show is a fiasco. He's not going to get paid. His costume's all burned. And he ends up in the final panel basically saying, maybe I'm just kidding myself. Maybe I've been defeated. Maybe Spider-Man's whole career has just been one big defeat, and I've just been too blind to notice. End story. Essence of Spider-Man. And
as I often say, cue the lonely man.
So this one's always been a favorite of mine.
This is... during the short-lived period, I think, if my memory is right, where they decided to do a lot of one-and-done stories.
This is one-and-done, yep.
They were trying to not do continued stories. And I think that did not necessarily work to their benefit. I don't mean this as a major criticism, but as a somewhat of a critique. The battle with Electro is almost given, second billing in this book, because you only have so many pages to work with, and they are so wrapped up in the subplots, the different things that are going on in his life, that takes center stage. And the battle with Electro is kind of the B story more than anything else. And that's okay, because I like the way the subplots go in this, but it definitely feels different from what we were getting at the time.
Well, you raise an interesting point in that they had completed, not too many issues before this, the Clay Tablet saga.
Which went on for, five issues?
It might have been seven or so, which is one of my favorite Spider-Man stories, period. And like you said, there's interweaving subplots in that. There's various villains involved in it. And maybe people were complaining. I mean, I love that story. But... I'll mildly beg to differ in that in this story, I actually like the fact that all the subplots and those characters are more front and center, because that's for me as a reader of Spider-Man, I was often more interested in all of that than I was in some of the Donnybrooks of the villains. I mean, I think the Electro battle is really well done. Like, Spidey uses his scientific knowledge to defeat him. And it also showcases what a complete lunatic Jameson is. He's actually orchestrated this confrontation in a public place with hundreds of people there, which Stacy and Robertson both point out. When you think about it, Jameson really should have been jailed many times over or sued for some of the things he was doing.
I mean the whole Spider Slayer thing, yeah. or the Scorpion.
Yeah, but I totally see your point. But I love the Peter angst and should I tell Gwen my identity or not? And the paper bag thing is, when you think about what comics were in this time period, this is another example of Marvel and Lee, pushing the envelope a little bit, doing something you wouldn't expect to see a superhero do. Just remind us that, Spider-Man is Peter Parker, and Peter Parker has all kinds of problems, just like, anybody in real life, and he's got, feet of clay and so forth.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I love the development of it, and I definitely get a kick out of the Gwen, Mary Jane, Betty Veronica vibe. Gwen is, like, at least at this point, and again, we mentioned earlier how Conway matured Mary Jane. Because Gwen is the perfect girlfriend, and then Mary Jane is the temptress.
Well, so, yeah.
And how she treats Harry is just despicable, actually.
Well, when we get to the drug issues, which I'm sure you've read,
We covered those recently.
Oh, wonderful. I'll have to listen to those. Harry, you know, part of the reason why he has a breakdown and turns to drugs, besides, of course, the fact that he's been emotionally abused by his father his entire life, is, you know, Mary Jane just kind of brushes him off, as was her wont at the time. And he kind of goes over the deep end. But what's great about, you're right, I mean, Conway, Mary Jane is always a fun character, interesting character in this period, but Conway really digs in and really says, you know what, there's something more to this character that I think we can work with. And, you know, he makes her a really interesting and important and engaging supporting character. I mean, she really becomes a main character as you think about it as the years go by. But Gwen is, look, Gwen, they often say, is more interesting in death than in life. I mean, Spider-Gwen, of course, is a whole different strand of that character. But if you go back and read these stories, you know, Gwen, like you said, is captive in some way to the girlfriend role. She's very smart. Sometimes she and Peter will have arguments, or she'll get impatient with, because she kind of perceives him as like someone who's never around when trouble happens, or he's kind of cowardly. And she's never apparently puts two and two together, unlike her father, who we know. And this they did hint at throughout the book, always knew that Peter was Spider-Man. Mm-hmm. So I thank you for this indulgence, this issue, because I hadn't read in a while, and it just put a big smile on my face.
No, as I mentioned to you, I always enjoy. I look forward to seeing what you're going to pick each time you come on, because it's always there may be differences in the grades. You know, some books might be an A, some might be a B, whatever, but I don't think you've ever picked one that wasn't worth discussing, put it that way. They always had something in there that was good. And this one does also. The interesting thing for me as I was reading this with, you know, the more critical eye, I've generally found Jim Mooney to be kind of bland, for lack of a better word. That it's just, you know, his inking never struck me as particularly special. I think he really stepped it up a notch in this one. On that splash page, the use of Zipitone, I think, is really well done on it.
Yep.
It creates, you know, that shadowy look and the darkness. And I think there's a darkness throughout this issue as far as the inking goes. You know, a lot of shadowy images and a lot of darker images. And I think it creates a real feel that I'm not used to from Mooney.
Well, I think he's stepping it up to meet the fact that Peter is, in terms of his internal, you know, dialogue with himself, is really struggling. This is like a lot of Spider-Man issues. This issue kind of ends, so to speak, on a down note. I mean, Peter feels like nothing's worked out. The TV show didn't work out and get the money. I burned my hand, singed my costume. I think that the inking, the whole approach to the book, you know, has to establish that feel. Mm-hmm. And I think you made a great point about the splash page and the way that page is rendered. You know, May's bedridden form sort of in shadow in the background. I mean, you know, it's her because it's clearly the outline of her, you know, very distinctive profile. But you're right. It's really good inking on that opening page.
I think I'm going to extend it to pretty much most of the book. I think the inking is really good. I think it creates a darker feeling on the pages when that would serve its purpose. There's somewhere, you know, where it's the very next page, except for the two panels of him looking in on Aunt May. You know, that those are kind of traditional bright colors, but I think where the darkness is useful, he makes good use of it.
Agreed.
Did you happen to see the alternate cover on this?
No, I have not.
I'm going to – now, this is not going to make for a good podcast listening, so I'm going to I'm going to edit this a little bit, but I'm going to share my screen with you to show you.
Is this an alternate cover from the time period that wasn't used?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Yes. I've never seen it.
A rejected cover.
Oh, I have seen this cover. Yes, yes. Oh, yeah.
I'm not exactly sure why this was rejected, frankly, and for those listening – the cover is the original. The cover of the issue has Electro on a boom mic, shooting shockwaves up at Spider-Man, who is, you know, above him,
Right.
And then down below, we see the TV audience, and there's the balcony, and you could see the TV cameras. The cover that was rejected, and they're both by Romita, by the way, is more of a close-up with Electro with his arms extended, shocking Spider-Man, who looks like he's getting knocked out. And it's a much more close-up image.
Maybe they wanted the audience, the readers, to understand this was actually taking place, you know, in a TV studio with an audience, to give that a greater sense of the danger of the situation. That's just a wild stab on my part.
Yeah, I'm not sure, because the original cover looks fine to me. Like, I don't really see a problem with it. Now, if you ask me which one is better, I'd be hard pressed to give a definitive answer, but I think I'd probably go with the one that they used. But it's close enough that if I was involved in Marvel editorial, if they came to me with that first cover, I'd say, yeah, it looks good. Let's go.
Well, it's John Romita Sr. doing Spider-Man covers. You're really not going to get many duds there.
But somebody, I assume Stan, looked at that and said, no, that's not what we want.
Well, I prefer the cover they use, only because you get, a heightened sense of the drama of the moment, because this battle is going on in the midst of all of these people. That's how I take it.
Yeah, and well, in the original cover, even though there's the floodlights behind him and the wires, that, you know, if once you know that they're on a TV stage, you can see that.
Yeah.
But you, those things probably wouldn't catch your eye, and all you would really see is Electro shocking Spider-Man.
Mm.
Whereas in the one that they used, it's, you know, it's clear that it's either a television studio or a TV set, or, you know, a movie studio, something with cameras and everything there. So it is a little bit more explaining the circumstance.
Right.
But this, you know, this, I started my first issue of Spider-Man as a collector, was 131. And then I started working my way back from there. So I had this probably with
131. We're talking the two-part Doc Ock, Mary's Aunt May Spider-Mobile stories, which were on the absurdity level are as high as they get, and they're two of my favorites.
and from an ownership point of view, the fact that I started there meant that when I started to go back, I was able to get 129. Probably, I think I paid $1 for it.
Oh, Paul.
So,
well, you have almost the entire series, don't you?
I am. I'll give you the exact number, because I do have almost the entire series that I want, to be
right.
To be fair, because I did put the.
You capped it.
I capped it at issue 300 for some reason.
Okay.
You know, no real reason other than I figured I have to cap it somewhere. So on my wish list now, if we count Amazing Fantasy 15, there are 15 books that I need.
Wow.
And everyone, the highest number of the ones I need is number 20.
20 is doable.
Yeah, no, this, I was looking, of the ones I need, the ones that are going to be really difficult to get are Amazing Fantasy, obviously, issue number one. And then from there, issue 3 with Doc Ock is probably going to be real difficult to get. Issue 14 with the Green Goblin. But I feel like every other one on my list here is obtainable to some extent.
The challenge is a lot of those issues, there are a lot of them are first appearances of a lot of Spider-Man's rogues gallery. So, you know, high grade is going to be, unless you're, you know, very well-off man who just has money to burn, it's going to be difficult to do.
What we like to call FU money.
Exactly. But really low grade reader copies, you probably can swing some of these.
Yeah, well, that's I've given up on trying to get high grade on these. If I can get them and they're not totally falling apart, I'm good.
Well, I think about in my years as a retailer. So I started retailing in 1999, and I had an Amazing Fantasy 15 in my store that I sold. That was like a good, very good, and that was worth like, I don't know, $1,500, $2,000. Then now it's worth like, you know, God.
Well,
five figures. So the prices have gone up so dramatically. I mean, I had as a retailer almost all the issues from the series at one point or another, except for issue one. I mean, I sold them
all. I had gone to a stand at New York Comic Con where they had a slabbed copy of Amazing Fantasy 15, and it was $4,000 for. Yeah, I mean, it was not. You know, it was a 2.5. It wasn't.
Yeah.
But it was like $4,000, and I just was like, I can't afford that. Meanwhile, if I could get that today for $4,000, well, sure. I would be all over.
But that's indicative of the fact that the prices on these books have gotten so high now that, like, when I started retailing, as I said before, as a retailer, I could actually afford to buy to sell a lot of those books. I mean, if you had some capital, you could get a lot of them. That's forget it now. I mean, you have to be really well off and really have access to a lot of capital to buy a lot of those books now.
Somebody messaged me on Facebook and offered me a copy of Amazing Fantasy 15, and he was from, I think he was from Ireland, but I'm not 100% sure. It wasn't this country. And forgetting the fact that, you know, if I were to give him the money, how am I guaranteeing I'm getting the book and all of that? he offered it to me for $15,000 or $16,000. Mm-hmm. And, you know, he said it was a beat up copy, but, you know, he said he had two copies, one of which was more beat up, and he was selling it to fund his wedding.
Oh.
So my response to him was, as much as I would love to have it, I would hate to fund your wedding and cost me my marriage. Although, and I often cite my wife as being an enabler, there was a point, I think I had told you this, like a year and a half ago, where I had to have surgery. And, you know, it was a significant surgery. And my wife had said something like, if you really want, just go and buy yourself that book. And what I explained to her, though, was, I said, that's great. I love that you feel that way or whatever. I said, but in your mind, you think if I get that book, I'm done. I said, and it doesn't work that way.
Well, good luck to you, Paul, on that quest.
Yeah, well, I'll keep looking. I doubt that I'll ever have it. But, I mean, I have a lot of key issues in my collection. I have X-Men number one. I have Giant Size X-Men number one. I have Hulk 181. Mm-hmm. I have Spider-Man 129.
Which you bought for a dollar.
What's that?
Which you bought for a dollar.
Yeah, which I bought for a dollar, exactly. Yeah. And I have, you know, a good number of other significant first appearances and such. I have Daredevil number one. I have Conan number one. You know, I have some pretty good books in my collection.
And you have Spider-Man 82, I'm sure.
Yes, I do. I have from 21 to 300, I have all of them. Mm. So it's just a matter of filling out. I figure of the 15 issues I need, at some point I'll probably obtain five or six or more of them, and that'll probably be about it. that's my guess.
We'll see. Sometimes, you know, life surprises you. You never know.
Yeah, you never know. I'm way ahead. So you want to read this book?
Sure. Let's see. So the cover, I think the cover's a solid A minus. I love that, you know, it's a typical Marvel cover of the time, and that it's, I shouldn't say typical. Sometimes the covers have nothing to do with the interior stories. But in this case, the cover, you know, is telling you the drama within, the fact that they're going to have this fight in a public place. It's very dynamic. I love it. The interior art, I give an A to. I love this whole period of Spider-Man. I love the artwork. I love the fact that Romita, who had so many, he was juggling so many balls at this point, doing comic book art, cover art, merch art. So he often would bring in other artists to help him. Sometimes he'd just do rough breakdowns, and like a John Buscema, another icon and master, would then carry the most of the load on that. Or you have someone like Mooney inking. And I just think Mooney's inking in this story, or perhaps his finishing, but it's kind of hard to tell where Romita starts and he ends, but is really dynamic, striking work. All the Spider-Man art from this period, I'm a huge fan of. The way Gwen is rendered, Mary Jane. Again, Romita brought that sensibility of the book where everybody, the joke is always kind of more attractive, better dressed. You know, it's really enjoyable art to take in. Story, this to me is just, for this period of Spider-Man, it's one of my favorite periods, like in terms of issue numbers, like Clay Tablet Saga through you know, like the drug issues are just, for me, is just gold. Subplots, fun battles with villains, etc. That's an A. And overall, we'll give it an A minus.
Okay. See, now the cover, if in a vacuum, I probably would have given this cover a B plus. But then I found the other cover for it. And then when we were comparing them, I said, if I had to pick, I'd pick the one that they ultimately used. Mm-hmm. And I would probably give the one they didn't use a B plus. Mm. So I'm going to bump this up to an A minus just because I think it's the preferable one of the two. Even though I like the other one very much as well. The interior art, like I said, I think this is as good as you get from Jim Mooney. I think this, and that's not meant to insult him. I mean, I'm saying this is really top notch.
Right.
I think you're right. I can't tell where Romita ends and Mooney begins because, you know, this is probably much more than just rough sketches from Romita. This is probably pretty detailed pencil work, but just the same, it comes together so well. Everybody's good looking. You know, I've had Chris Tyler on who comments about Kirby, saying Kirby draws some of the best ugly people in the world. Romita draws some of the best good-looking people.
Well, we have to remember, Romita was a romance artist for several years at DC before he returned to Marvel.
And yes.
He chose.
So I'm going to say an A on the interior art. I think it's top-notch. The story, you know, I criticize it for being one and done, but it's not really one and done because all the subplots are playing into ongoing things. And will continue. So while the super villain battle is one and done, the ongoing saga of Peter Parker is, you know, well taken care of here. So I'm going to say a solid B plus on the story. I think that, you know, the battle could have been a little bit more fleshed out, but I'm still good with it. And overall, I'm going to give this book, much like the last one, an A minus.
Paul, we're almost in accord. Magnificent.
Yes. and it's always a pleasure to have you on, Chris.
Thanks, brother.
I love your knowledge and your enthusiasm with these books.
Well, so, honored you gave me the platform. I appreciate it, sir.
I look forward to the next time that I can get you on. You know, I mentioned earlier that some of Chris's podcasting brethren were scheduled to be on with us today. And weren't able to, and they all said, hey, you know, we'll pick another date and we'll do it. And certainly whenever we do that, Chris, you're always welcome to join in as
Thanks,
well.
Thanks, pal. If I'm available, I'll be happy to.
So I'll look forward to that. And thank you for coming on, and thank you everybody for listening, and we'll see you next time. Bye-bye.
Take care, gang.
Thank you so much for listening to our show, and we hope you'll continue to join us each and every week for more good old-fashioned comic book back issue awesomeness. You can contact Back to the Bins to leave feedback, comments, questions, suggestions, and criticisms via email at bins@twotruefreaks.com or by joining the Back to the Bins group on Facebook. Back to the Bins is a proud affiliate of the Two True Freaks Internet Radio Network, which you may find at www.twotruefreaks.com. Two True Freaks is a registered trademark of DiManzo Corp of Milan, Italy. All rights reserved. Please take a moment to stop by the twotruefreaks.com site and check out their many other fine podcasts, won't you? Thanks, and we'll see you next week.